recommended her. I asked around. She has a good reputation in the city, and she's available. It's almost impossible to find a tutor willing to spend 3 hours every day with a student. Every day. Most weekdays. She agreed to work every afternoon for the next month or so. It's the slow season for guides. She might have a job once or twice a week, but she'll try to be on call. Relax. She's good. What's her fee? 200 euros a week, until spring when tourism picks up. Whitaker rolled his eyes as if the money would come directly from his salary. Marco's costing too much, he said almost to himself. Marco has a great idea. He wants to go to Australia or New Zealand or someplace where the language won't be a problem. He wants a transfer? Yes, and I think it's a great idea. Let's dump him on someone else. That's not our decision, is it, Luigi? I guess not. The salads arrived, and they were quiet for a moment. Then Whitaker said, I still don't like this woman. Keep looking for someone else. There is no one else. What are you afraid of? Marco has a history with women, okay? There's always the potential for romance. She could complicate things. I've warned her. And she needs the money. She's broke? I get the impression things are very tight. It's the slow season, and her husband is not working. Whitaker almost smiled, as if this was good news. He stuffed a large wedge of tomato in his mouth and chomped on it while peering around the trattoria to see if anyone was eavesdropping on their hushed conversation in English. When he was finally able to swallow, he said, Let's talk about email. Marco was never much of a hacker. Back in his glory days, he lived on the phone, had 4 or 5 of them in his office, 2 in his car, 1 in his pocket, always juggling 3 conversations at once. He bragged about charging $5,000 just to take a phone call from a new client, that sort of crap. Never used the computer. Those who worked for him have said that he occasionally read emails, he rarely sent them, and when he did, it was always through a secretary. His office was high-tech, but he hired people to do the grunt work. He was too much of a big shot. What about prison? No evidence of email. He had a laptop which he used only for letters, never email. It looks as though everyone abandoned him when he took the fall. He wrote occasionally to his mother and his son, but always used regular mail. Sounds completely illiterate. Sounds like it, but Langley's concerned that he might try and contact someone on the outside. He can't do it by phone, at least not now. He has no address he can use, so mail is probably out of the question. He'd be stupid to mail a letter, Luigi said. It might divulge his whereabouts. Exactly. Same for the phone, fax, everything but email. We can track email. Most of it, but there are ways around it. He has no computer and no money to buy one. I know, but hypothetically, he could sneak into an internet cafe, use a coded account, send the email, then clean his trail, pay a small fee for the rental, and walk away. Sure, but who's going to teach him how to do that? He can learn. He can find a book. It's unlikely, but there's always a chance. I'm sweeping his apartment every day, Luigi said. Every inch of it. If he buys a book or lays down a receipt, I'll know it. Scope out the internet cafes in the neighborhood. There are several of them in Bologna now. I know them. Where's Marco right now? I don't know. It's Saturday, a day off. He's probably roaming the streets of Bologna, enjoying his freedom. And he's still scared. He's terrified. Mrs. Ruby Osbury took a mild sedative and slept for 6 of the 8 hours it took to fly from Milano to Dulles International. The lukewarm coffee they served before landing did little to clear the cobwebs, and as the 747 taxied to the gate, she dozed off again. She forgot about the birthday card as they were herded onto the cattle cars on the tarmac and driven to the main terminal. She forgot about it as she waited with the mob to claim her baggage and plod through customs. And she forgot about it when she saw her beloved granddaughter waiting for her at the arrival exit. She forgot about it until she was safely at home in York, Pennsylvania, and shuffling through her shoulder bag for a souvenir. "Oh, my," she said as the card fell onto the kitchen table. "I was supposed to drop this off at the airport." Then she told her granddaughter the story of the poor guy in the Milan airport who had just lost his passport and would miss his father's 90th birthday. Her granddaughter looked at the envelope. "Doesn't look like a birthday card," she said. She studied the address, R.N. Backman, Attorney at Law, 412 Main Street, Culpeper, Virginia, 22701. "There's no return address," the granddaughter said.
"I'll mail it first thing in the morning," Mrs. Osbury said. "I hope it arrives before the birthday."
Chapter 17. At 10 Monday morning in Singapore, the mysterious $3 million sitting in the account of Old Stone Group Limited made an electronic exit and began a quiet journey to the other side of the world. 9 hours later, when the doors of the Galleon Bank and Trust opened on the Caribbean island of St. Christopher, the money arrived promptly and was deposited in a numbered account with no name. Normally, it would have been a completely anonymous transaction, one of several thousand that Monday morning, but Old Stone now had the full attention of the FBI. The bank in Singapore was cooperating fully. The bank on St. Christopher was not, though it would soon get the opportunity to participate. When Director Anthony Price arrived in his office at the Hoover Building before dawn on Monday, the hot memo was waiting. He canceled everything planned for that morning. He huddled with his team and waited for the money to land on St. Christopher. Then he called the vice president. It took 4 hours of undiplomatic arm-breaking to shake the information loose on St. Christopher. At first, the bankers refused to budge, but what small quasi-nation can withstand the full might and fury of the world's only superpower? When the vice president threatened the prime minister with economic and banking sanctions that would destroy what little economy the island was clinging to, he finally knuckled under and turned on his bankers. The numbered account could be directly traced to Artie Morgan, the 31-year-old son of the former president. He had been in and out of the Oval Office during the final hours of his father's administration, sipping Heinekens and occasionally dispensing advice to both Kritz and the president. The scandal was ripening by the hour. From Grand Cayman to Singapore and now to St. Christopher, the wiring bore the telltale signs of an amateur trying to cover his tracks. A professional would have split the money 8 ways and parked it in several different banks in different countries, and the wires would have been months apart. But even a rookie like Artie should have been able to hide the cash. The offshore banks he selected were secretive enough to protect him. The break for the feds had been the mutual fund crook desperate to avoid prison. However, there was still no evidence as to the source of the money. In his last 3 days in office, President Morgan granted 22 pardons. All went unnoticed except two, Joel Backman and Duke Mongo. The FBI was hard at work digging for financial dirt on the other 20. Who had $3 million? Who had the resources to get it? Every friend, family member, and business associate was being scrutinized by the feds. A preliminary analysis repeated what was already known. Mongo had billions and was certainly corrupt enough to bribe anyone. Backman, too, could pull it off. A third possibility was a former New Jersey state legislator whose family made a bundle in government road contracts. 12 years earlier, he had gone to federal camp for a few months and now wanted his rights restored. The president was off in Europe in the middle of his Get Acquainted tour, his first victory lap around the world. He wouldn't be back for 3 days, and the vice president decided to wait. They would watch the money, double and triple check the facts and details, and when he returned, they would brief him with an airtight case. A cash for pardon scandal would electrify the country. It would humiliate the opposition party and weaken its resolve in Congress. It would ensure that Anthony Price would head the FBI for a few more years. It would finally send old Teddy Maynard off to the retirement home. There was simply no downside to the launching of a full federal blitz against an unsuspecting ex-president. His tutor was waiting in